ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife. News breakdown.
Well, this coming Wednesday, representatives of all Australian governments are going to meet to urgently consider ways of stopping violence against women. Tens of thousands of Australians marched in cities across the country over the weekend, calling for national action on the problem, and the need is urgent. At least 27 women have died so far this year from gender-based violence. Now, community organisations want the National Cabinet to focus on the long-term support of women and children, as well as interventions that are working already. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, identified a critical factor in finding solutions.
We have to change culture. This isn't something that requires a one-off action. This is something that requires concerted action from all levels of government, from the media, from all levels of society to change culture.
And that's not going to be a quick process. The Minister for Women, Katie Gallagher, says the government's got an open mind to ideas for further action to address gender-based violence.
We always need to look at whether things are working, whether we need to shift focus or you know, look at new ways, particularly in the area of prevention, about how we provide support and services. So I think from our point of view, we have an open mind.
But a distraction emerged today with a clash between the Prime Minister and the organisers of yesterday's Canberra rally against gendered violence, with accusations that the Prime Minister had not told the truth about whether or not he was invited to speak to the rally. Now, the organiser of the march, Sarah Williams, says his office made it clear that he didn't plan to speak, but the Prime Minister told the crowd his request to speak was refused. Katie Gallagher says she wasn't aware of an invitation for the government to speak. Anthony Albanese says he nevertheless was pleased to participate in the rally.
Women in particular are very frustrated and they're angry, and that is understandable that that is the case. I wish Sarah well. She did very well in organising the rallies, as did everyone there.
Well, Nationals leader David Littleproud weighed in also. He says the Prime Minister was, quote, tone deaf.
I have no sympathy for him whatsoever. If he had issues about whether he was invited or not, making it public in front of all those people was not the forum to do it. He could have had those conversations in private, and he got what he deserved. But it's important now that he focuses on outcomes.
Well, Claire Armstrong, News Corp's national political editor, attended yesterday's rally, reported on the spat over the speeches, and joins us now for our news breakdown. Claire, good evening. Welcome back, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the rally. What was the mood?
There were various phases. There was quite an emotional afternoon with more than 5,000 people in Canberra doing a sort of 10-minute march across Lake Burley Griffin, ending on the lawns of Parliament in front of Parliament House there, where speeches started. Obviously, the Prime Minister and several of his ministers took part. The organiser of the rally, Sarah Williams, she spoke quite passionately about her own experience with gendered violence. And unfortunately, the mood of the rally kind of descended into this tense and quite anxious situation where there were demands put to the Prime Minister, where organisers wanted him to agree to a lot of their key asks, things like declaring domestic and national violence a national emergency, mandatory training around victim blaming for frontline workers and media. Unfortunately, there were some crossed wires. The Prime Minister and his colleagues didn't feel able to indicate their support one way or the other with a thumbs up or down as requested from the crowd. And that then descended into some people wanting him to speak, others being less inclined to give him the microphone. But ultimately, debate ensued. He took the mic and, you know, the rest, as they say, is history, and or depending on where you were standing, I think everyone has a slightly different perspective of how it went down. But from where I was, which was quite close to the stage, I would say some well-intentioned views, and the attendance of the PM itself kind of unfortunately has been a little bit lost in some failures or differences of remembrance of communication about the plan for the rally.
Yes, it's a pity in a way that this issue seems to have, taken over some of the more important things that are at hand here. National Cabinet's meeting on Wednesday. What can we expect there, do you think?
They've kept it really broad. Obviously, the reason for this special meeting is domestic and family violence and tackling it. So far, we know some of the things on the agenda is going to be, for example, online harms and how misogyny and other, and you know, issues like that kind of spread on social media. We also know there's going to be talk about sharing between jurisdictions information of repeat offenders or high risk perpetrators. Obviously, people are unfortunately all too aware that sometimes if a perpetrator crosses state lines, the information around their alleged previous behaviour doesn't necessarily make its way to the next state law enforcement. So there's sort of some real specific issues that will be drilled down there into how frontline services can do more, both to support victim survivors, but also address some of the issues around perpetrators.
I mean, that's right, it's a national cabinet issue, but I mean, it has to be said that a lot of the criminal law in all these states in relation to these issues is state-based, isn't it? And, you know, there are different approaches and resources and situations that operate in each state as well. You'd love to have a single national approach, and you'd hope that that would come out, but it's more difficult than it seems, I would think.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. I've seen over the years with this national cabinet approach, and even COAG before it, we're getting closer to standardising. You know, we've seen the criminalisation of coercive control and things like that be standardised across states and territories because they're able to discuss and work through these issues in these forums. So I have a little bit of hope that bringing all of the states and territories around the one table will eventually lead us to a bit more of a standardised approach to a lot of these domestic and family violence issues.
Yeah, certainly tightening bail conditions and also making those bail conditions much more adhered to seems to be something that could be done in the short term. In other respects, it's hard to see that, you know, immediate things are going to turn around what's become an endemic social problem, it must be said.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's why we see the government saying they want to end this within a generation, because it probably is going to take that much of a societal change to really get people to understand that these harmful attitudes toward women in some parts of society are translating into direct physical harms.
Exactly. A woman dies every 10 days. It's just, it's completely unacceptable. All right. Look, the Prime Minister's arrived in Alice Springs. Now, this is 2 weeks after the end of the town's snap youth curfew. He's getting about, Mr. Albanese. His last visit to the town was in January 2023 at the height of a local crime wave, and the federal government shortly after announcing some $250 million in funding for Central Australia to be spent on a wide range of social issues. What's he here for now, Claire? What's he aiming to achieve?
Well, to hear from the PM himself, when he arrived this afternoon, he said that he's really just here to check up on the progress of a lot of the government made a $250 million Central Australia funding commitment back in January last year when he last visited. And he so far has visited a health hub that's being constructed. He's going to be meeting with local councillors, business owners, attending a school that's managed to get school attendance to be a bit higher in Alice Springs. So he's really going to check in on the progress of a lot of the projects that was sort of sparked out of that initial, you probably recall, quite a big focus on Alice Springs about a year ago.
Yeah, there was. The issues, though, seems to be getting back to what the conditions are like at home for a lot of Indigenous young people who clearly don't find it an inviting prospect to be there. And that's maybe not so easily resolved, is it?
No, and I think, you know, obviously Alice has just ended this three-week period, I think it was, of having a curfew for young people, where they had to be home by six unless they had another reason. Of course, it's easy to enforce something like that if people have an appropriate and safe home to be in. So I think that issue is a long way from being resolved in a more permanent way.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Look, some news just out. The embargo has just lifted on this. In the wake of the Optus outage debacle last year, the federal government's agreed to implement changes, especially to Australia's 000 service. Claire, what's happening? What are they looking at?
Yeah, well, people will remember, if they were an Optus user in November, losing all phone and internet connection, which was hardly very handy, but then obviously had more of a serious risk for some people who needed during that period to reach 000 and found that they couldn't. As a result of several failures, the government is now looking to basically keep a much more active look at how the 000 network is going. They're going to be doing things like forcing the telcos to test every 6 months all of their systems to make sure that at every point there's continued access to 000. They're going to be requiring, they're going to be implementing someone to oversee the 000 system and make sure that there's no one falling through the cracks. And on some of the other issues, something as basic as, again, Optus users might remember this, pretty hard to know what's going on with an Optus outage if you have no phone or internet or ability to read the news. So they're going to mandate how and when and where telcos communicate to their customers when there's been an outage. So using more traditional media, radio, TV, things that obviously aren't reliant on the internet to ensure that their customers have a clue what the hell is going on.
They've stopped short of mandating that in such instances, customers should be shifted onto others' networks, I presume.
Yes, it's more about ensuring that at least for emergency calls, there's no disruption.
Yeah, it's quite critical. The report has been quite critical of Optus's communication around the outage, calling it inadequate, which I think everyone would mightily agree with. Look, just before we go, the one of the more colourful court cases going on at the moment, Senator Pauline Hanson is back in court. This time, she's facing accusations of racism from her fellow senator, Greens Deputy Leader Maureen Faruqi. Now, this is over a tweet made by Senator Pauline Hanson in relation to criticisms that Senator Faruqi had made of the royal, not the royal family as much as the idea of the royal family and their sovereignty over Australia. Senator Pauline Hanson told Maureen Faruqi in a tweet that if she didn't like Australia, given that she'd benefited from it, she could, quote, piss off back to Pakistan. Now, the court will hear evidence that the One Nation leader is a well-known, long-standing and prolific sayer of racist things. In short, Maureen Faruqi has launched a claim of racial discrimination over the tweet. Now, Senator Faruqi's legal team said it'll provide evidence to the court to prove the comment was racially motivated. Senator Hanson's lawyers told the court Senator Faruqi's tweet was intended to offend and provoke a response. What can we expect out of all this, Claire?
A lot of lawyers are going to make a lot of money. I think that's the main thing you can expect out of this. Look, I mean, you've got two very outspoken senators from very different points of the political spectrum. I think that what we can expect out of this is an interesting test case for the Racial Discrimination Act, but maybe these aren't necessarily the two most clear people to be leading this particular example. Look, I think, a lot is being said in this court case, and I think Faruqi called the ultimate racist slur to be told to go back to the country that she obviously was born in originally. Mm. And I'm sure there are many Australians who were born overseas who would totally agree with that sentiment. Mm. I'm no lawyer, so I don't know how far the Discrimination Act goes, but it's been interesting to see this one get as far as it has in terms of being in an open trial. Mm.
I mean, I do wonder, there's a sort of a broader political point here as to whether or not what people make of the fact that, you know, these are highly paid senators of the Australian Parliament with a parliamentary chamber to resolve these disagreements where they are immune from legal action, as to whether or not, you know, the court's time should be taken up solving their disputes, which could easily be solved in the parliament, you might think.
Yeah, well, I think it is, to that point, the fact that this, the case centres around a tweet, which obviously was not said on the floor of Parliament. Similar sentiments were said, but this specific tweet obviously isn't covered by parliamentary privilege. It definitely, like I said, the only real winners here to me are the lawyers.
All right, Claire. Always great to talk. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.